Good afternoon. Welcome to the New York University Law School. This is the Brennan Center for Justice event. Our programs and podcasts, just as a reminder, are available on iTunes and on our website at brennancenter.org, BRENNANcenter.org. And follow us also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Donna Edwards. I'm a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, and I'm your moderator for today's program. Not that I've been there, but in ancient and European history, constitutional scholars assumed that economic inequality was inevitable and that it designed governments to prevent class divisions from spilling over into class warfare. But our guest today, Ganesh Sitaraman, argues that the American Constitution needs a strong and sizable middle class to survive. With economic and political inequality on the rise, Americans face a choice of whether to accept rising economic inequality and risk oligarchy, or choose instead to build the middle class and reclaim our republic in the process. As the longtime legal advisor to Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Professor Sitaraman has a unique voice in the debate over economic inequality. In his recent book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, right here, he describes inequality in more than just a moral or economic problem. It threatens the very core of our constitutional system. The professor teaches at Vanderbilt Law School and is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a graduate of Harvard Law School. Welcome, Ganesh Sitaraman, to the Brennan Center for Justice. So in, in some ways, and if you all haven't had a chance to, you will afterwards be able to get a copy of the book. Just want to remind you before we get started so that we can hear everything, that you turn off your cell phones. I'm watching. Turn them off. Thank you very much, because it'll help all of us today as we get started. One of the things that I was struck by when I read the book is that, you know, you've said that universal societies were subject to constant strife, even revolution. The rich would tyrannize the poor would revolt against the rich. What is it exactly about economic inequality that doesn't work for Americans, and why is that a constitutional theory?
Great. Well, thank you so much, Donna, for the introduction. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank NYU and the Brennan Center for having me, and thank all of you for coming and using up your lunchtime to hear about American history and the Constitution. I know we're at the Brennan Center, so you have an interest in both of these topics, but I still appreciate taking time out of your day to be here. So the question's a really good one. What does the middle class, what does economic inequality have to do with the Constitution? Constitution doesn't say economic equality in it, doesn't say economic inequality in it, doesn't say middle class in it, says nothing about any of these concepts. And what I argue in the book is that there is a structural principle underlying our Constitution. It's an assumption that our Constitution requires a society that has relative economic equality. And the way that we can see that is by thinking about what came before our Constitution. And so from the ancient Greeks and Romans all the way up through the 18th century, people were very, very worried about economic inequality. And as you just summarized, you know, they worried that in a society that was very divided, the rich would try to oppress the poor, or the poor would revolt against that, and they would try to confiscate all the wealth of the rich. And so the result is that you would see constant strife and potentially even revolution. And so the answer to this problem for most of history was to build economic class right into the structure of government. In England, you have a House of Lords for the wealthy. You have a House of Commons for everybody else. In ancient Rome, there's a patrician senate for the wealthy. But then there's the tribune of the plebs, the plebeians, for everybody else. And the idea here is that each class is represented in government, has a share and a stake in government, but also has a check on the other class. And that's what's going to prevent conflict and instability. Now, what's striking about our Constitution is that we don't have a House of Lords. We don't have a Tribune of the Plebs. In fact, we don't have any structural parts of our Constitution that represent economic classes. And this was something that the founding generation debated. Our state constitutions in the American Revolutionary period, actually many of them had these kinds of provisions in them. They debated them in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia. And they did not put these kinds of features into our Constitution. And part of the reason they didn't do that is because people believed that America was uniquely equal in the history of the world. Their baseline that they were comparing themselves to was Europe. And unlike Europe, there was no feudalism in America. Unlike Europe, there was no hereditary aristocracy in America. And unlike Europe, there was a lot of land to the west. And what that meant was that any white man, we'll talk more about that, I suspect, later, could become a farmer and have a plot of land himself, and property was the main form of wealth at the time. And so what this meant was they could imagine that America was the most equal society the world had ever seen, and that as a result, they didn't need to have any of these class structures built into our Constitution. And this was a radical thing in the design of constitutions, and that's the kind of core argument of the book, is that this structural feature of our system is that we don't have what most republics from the ancient world until the 18th century had before us, which was an understanding that economic class should be built right into the structure of government. And that was because people assumed we would just not be afflicted by the problem of inequality.
So that really works for the group of white men who decided to do that. How does that work for the rest of us?
So the story of the middle class constitutional tradition, which I trace in the book, says that in order to have a republic, you have to have a big middle class, relatively low inequality, within the political community. But it leaves open this huge question, who's in the political community? And that's a question that's obviously been contested, including violently, in our history. And I think what we've seen is that we have a second tradition, a tradition of inclusion. And over time, we have expanded our political community to include minorities, to include women, as full members of our political community. And what I think is really important is what happens when these two traditions intersect. So when you expand the political community, it now becomes necessary to ensure that everyone in the political community can be in the middle class as well, or else our constitutional system doesn't work the way it was designed. The assumptions are undermined. And a lot of people throughout our history actually understood this. And so I'll just give a good example from the book. After the Civil War, the Reconstruction Republicans were not just interested in emancipation and political rights for the former slaves of the South. They were interested in economic justice. And, you know, Thaddeus Stevens, congressman from Pennsylvania, proposed actually confiscating the wealth of the top 10% of Confederate planters and redistributing it to their former slaves in 40-acre parcels. This is the era where 40 acres and a mule as an idea comes from. And the reason Stevens believed this is because he thought that the southern states had been despotisms at this up until this point, not real republics. And that it was not possible to have a true republic or a democracy unless there was an economic distribution of wealth in addition to political equality. And so by this act of both stripping the wealthiest people from their lands and redistributing it, he would end both the landed aristocracy in the South and the landless class of former slaves in the South. That was the idea behind it. Now, obviously, Reconstruction was not successful in doing this, but it was a sense that people understood that these two things are linked. It's not just political equality, it's also economic equality that you need to sustain a republic.
Well, I mean, so let's bring us up to date, because, you know, some would argue that right now we have such a breakdown in that structure, that we have growing and inequality more than we've had at any other time. I talked to you earlier about this. I think it's kind of a blip that we had a growing middle class. That was about 20 years, 30 years, the 50s, you know, roughly to the 70s. And if you look at all of the rest of our 241 years, they were more about inequality than they were economic equality.
So, I think I slightly disagree in the sense that I think early on in the Republic, prior to industrialization, we have some evidence that there was relative equality in that period. So and there's a study from Peter Lindert at Berkeley and Jeff Williamson at Harvard looking at inequality at the edge of the American Revolution in 1774. And it's very hard to get data here, but through some complex means, they've cobbled together data on what incomes looked like on the edge of the revolution. And what they find is that in America in 1774, the top 1% of people take home about 8.5% of the national income. Now, for comparison, that's about the same as the top 1% took home in 1976, about 8.5%. Today, the top 1% take home more than 20% of national income. And by the way, their numbers on 1774 include slavery. So the slave-owning America of 1774 is more equal than today's America on their numbers. So I think there's some point there that we had a little greater equality. The big change is industrialization. So in the 19th century, everything changes. We move to urbanization, the closing of the frontier, the shift from agricultural work and artisanal labor to wage work in factories. We have urbanization. All of these things are fundamental changes to our economic system. The rise of the corporation, obviously, is another major one. And these things all concentrate wealth in a way that has never really existed, in America to the same degree. And so this is an era in the Gilded Age where you have robber barons, monopolies, and major concentrations of wealth and power that people are very worried are going to spill into and are spilling into government and corrupting our political system. And so I think in some ways we're similar to that era. People often talk about this era as a second Gilded Age as a result. And I agree that, in that context, the mid-20th century seems exceptional. Because we have this default, at least since industrialization, of inequality. Why did that happen? I think there's a number of reasons. One is, after World War II, much of the between the Depression and the war, much of the rest of the world has been destroyed. Europe has been blown up quite a bit from the war. The rest of the world has faced the World War. We were relatively protected, given to oceans and distance. And that meant that America had a significant ability in the post-war era to grow. In addition, we took on a bunch of policy things that really helped the middle class grow. So this is a period starting with the New Deal and going forward in which we regulated finance heavily through the Securities and Exchange Commission, through Glass-Steagall. We had extremely high top marginal tax rates, 90% coming out of World War II, and then 70% through the 70s. This is an era in which we invested money into building a middle class. So the GI Bill sends a generation to college. We have Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, all things that are trying to lift up the poor and make inequality less of an issue. And so I think partly, this was an era in which we were very successful because we made ourselves successful. And partly there was a lot of other factors around the world that that certainly helped it as well.
Well, talk about the transition period that we're in now coming out of all of that, sort of the work to build a middle class, and not just the 2008 recession, because, people argue that that too was, that's part of a litany of things that have happened over the last couple of decades, but it doesn't stand alone in terms of pushing down the middle class.
Yeah, so I think right now what we're seeing is there's a whole bunch of things that have contributed to rising inequality and to our current conditions. And so this is not just something that started with the crash in 2008. We can look back over the last 30 years or so and see a wide variety of changes. A few things compared to the post-war era. We have a totally different kind of tax policy than we used to have then. Compared to the post-war era, we spent 30 years deregulating finance prior to the crash. Compared to the post-war era, when coming right out of World War II, about 30% of Americans were members of a union. Now we're at about 10%. Unions are very important because they're the only organization, according to political scientists, that consistently advocate on behalf of working people in Washington in policy fights, whether they're members of a union or not. And so the erosion of unions means the countervailing power in Washington and how policy takes place has really been eroded significantly. So I think on a wide variety of these metrics, things have really changed from where we were before.
And in the book, you also discuss the role of our political structure and political system, the campaign finance system, the way we hold elections, as one of the contributing factors as well of this erosion that we've seen over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, so I'll give you a little historical framework as maybe a way to think about this. So in the first Gilded Age, when inequality was high, when people were very worried about robber barons and monopolists, the populists and then the progressives decided that inequality was a major threat to our democracy. And they had two strategies for how to fix it. The first was to attack economic concentrations of power. And the way they did that was they came up with a bunch of new ideas. They invented antitrust laws to break up big monopolies. They passed a constitutional amendment to create an income tax so that there would be higher rates on the wealthiest people. They passed minimum wage laws, those come out of this period, in order to lift up workers who are now working in factories. The populists, actually, this is another interesting one, the populists in the 1880s actually advocate also for equal pay for equal work for women, and that's exactly the phrase they use, equal pay for equal work. It's from the 1880s, and we still talk about that today. So that's on the economic side. The second thing they were worried about is that economic power would convert into political power and would mean that the wealthiest people would be able to rig the political system in their favor. And so they devised a bunch of strategies to try to make politics more democratic and more responsive to the people rather than the wealthiest interests. So the first campaign finance laws come from the Progressive Era. And this is a period where they also passed a constitutional amendment so that senators would be directly elected by the people instead of selected by state legislatures. And the reason for that was state legislatures were easily bought through corruption, and they believed that it would be much harder to bribe the entire population of the state to reward some robber baron with a Senate seat. And so those changes, both economic and political, were how they tried to wrestle with the problem of concentrated wealth and power. And I think that basically provides the appropriate framework that we need to be thinking about today, which is what can we do both on the economic side, but then on the political side, how can we rein in both the influence that money has over politics, but also make our political system more democratic and more responsive to ordinary people and their interests?
Well, so let's go to that place, because I think part of your argument is that if we don't begin to reframe our policy toward that middle-class constitution that you describe as the origin, that we run the risk that the entire system falls apart. And so what are the things that we can do now that you would say we'd inject into the system to prevent that?
So I think we follow basically the playbook in some ways from 100 years ago. We need to do things on the economic side. Antitrust is a great example of something that has been relatively unenforced in any serious sense in the last generation. We live in an era in which most major sectors of our economy are now consolidated and run by a very, very small number of companies. Our antitrust laws are designed to prevent that. We have policies now in which some of the wealthiest people in the country earn income in certain ways. That means they pay lower tax rates than people who are working class. That is crazy. That's not how we should think about an income tax system. We have spent a lot of time, or many people in politics have spent a lot of time attacking forms of organizing workers, whether through unions or outside of that, that's something that obviously needs to change as well. So I think there are big things we can do there on the policy side. And a big part of that is just people out there demanding of the people they're electing, not just populist rhetoric, but actual action on these core economic questions in order to rebalance the economic power in our society. And then the same thing is true on the political side. You know, we see consistently people wanting to talk about how rigged the government is, but then they don't support campaign finance reforms. They don't support conflicts of interest reforms. They don't support closing the revolving door. You know, you can talk about draining the swamp or ending the rigged game or whatever, but you actually have to do something about it. And that's really something that it falls to us, the people, to force them to do. So I don't sound totally crazy in saying we all the people should just do this. I'll give you an example of a place where we actually did this in a way that's really surprising. So if you want a constitutional amendment to get rid of senators being selected by state legislatures, what you have to do is get, and this is what the progressives did, you have to get Congress first on board, which includes the senators who were selected through this mechanism of being picked by the state legislatures. Then you've got to get the amendment ratified by the state legislatures who currently have the benefit of getting to pick the senators. So they've got to do something that reduces their power. So how did they get rid of this? How did they change this? And the answer is 100 years ago, and this thing that you would never expect senators to agree to, you'd never expect state legislatures to agree to, people just started having almost a litmus test and saying, I will not vote for any state legislator who does not support a popular choice of senator. And over time, they weeded out enough state legislators that you would then have popular choices, and the senators who were selected knew they were selected because they were a popular, they would be part of that kind of popular method of selection. And you got changed that way. But it was people demanding it. And it took about 30 years for that to happen. It took a long time from the first inklings of reform all the way through until that passed. And so I think that kind of sustained engagement, which isn't going to be something you can do on one weekend or in one year or in one election cycle, but really building through is how we're going to make this happen.
Well, Professor, I have to say, I mean, when I was in the House, we routinely described the Senate as the House of Lords. And so I think we've got a lot of work to do. You know, I wondered, you know, as I was
reading... They describe you as the House of Commons?
Well, they didn't. Mostly they just ignored us. But it did occur to me when I was reading. I mean, you go through a whole sort of history of describing the Greeks and the Romans and ancient systems that were moving toward democracy, but still ways that they were trying to empower the lower classes, basically to prevent revolt, right? I mean, so it seems to me that there are some things that are built in our system like that, too.
Things that empower people?
That empower people to, you know, sort of tamp down the, you know, I'm thinking, for example, in this discussion about tax reform, that... you know, the face of tax reform is the family farmer, it's the small business, and yet much of the so-called reforms really don't benefit that family farmer and that small business. That becomes ways that you kind of co-opt what should be the middle class supporting ideas that really lift the middle class instead of the upper echelons.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's two things we can distinguish. One are, what are institutional structures that are there that support people and act as a check? And actually, in some ways, maybe we do have some in our Constitution. I'll give you one example, though it's fallen into disuse and in some cases has a bad reputation, but is the jury, right? The idea of a jury is that you are being judged by your peers, by a kind of random group of citizens who are non-experts and so on. Now, most of the time now, lawyers, prosecutors rarely go to trial, rarely get to it in front of a jury. But that the idea behind that provides some sort of institutional check in some ways against overreach. The second thing, though, is how do we make arguments about different policies? And I think one of the challenges that we have is if you don't make forceful arguments, you guarantee that that argument will not be heard by people. And I think in a large part, we've spent a long time watching politicians not make arguments about these issues. And so, you know, one of the goals I had in the book was to say that we need to work on these economic questions not just because of moral reasons or policy reasons or economic theory reasons, but because they're vital to our constitutional system, vital to having the kind of freedom in a democracy that we believe we want to have and that people throughout our history have wanted to have. And that is an argument that unless we make it, will not get made. And other kinds of arguments will fill that space. And so I think it's important that we actually do just make these arguments forthrightly and without being apologetic for them.
Well, one of the challenges of a book like this, I think, arguing from both the text and the notes and the history of the Constitution as a middle-class constitution, is that is essentially a conservative idea. The idea that you put forward of looking at both the text and the origin of the Constitution and the intent of the founding fathers, but it would, I mean, the policies that would come out of it wouldn't necessarily lead to what we would conventionally describe as conservative policy.
So I'd rather not, I don't think it's a conservative idea in a sense, but I think that today in politics, certainly, it's uncomfortable to everybody. I think there are many liberals who would prefer not to think about the founding or American history at all if they can help it. And that's how I make the argument. It's a kind of narrative history of America. To many conservatives who like focusing on the founding and American history, it turns out that many of the founders were very, very worried about inequality and advocated for things like taxation on wealthier people, preventing creating an aristocracy by descending wealth to your children and grandchildren. And that may be uncomfortable to them because the policy outcomes don't fit with where their preferences are. So I think there's something kind of from both sides to learn about here. But I think the bigger lesson is, you know, part of who we are as a country and what unites us is thinking about where we've come from for both good and ill and telling a story about what our values are. And our values are built into a set of structures, are built into documents, are built into successes and failures that we've had as a people. And I think, you know, relying and thinking about the Constitution is something that that we all should be doing as a way to think about how we move forward and who we are and what our core principles are as a country.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that you go sort of right to the Constitution. I tried to ignore most of my con law learning, clearly. But did your experience on Capitol Hill impact the way you began to think about this idea and pushing this idea out?
Yeah, so I think it did in a couple of ways. First is as I came to this book after having worked in campaigns in the Senate, and when I came back to being an academic, started thinking about and looking for what people who do constitutional law, which is what I focus on, what they'd been saying since the crash about economic inequality and economic issues. And it turned out the answer was not much. And so I thought, you know, this would be a good thing to investigate and really see how people throughout our history grappled with this core question that we are dealing with today. And that was part of the origins of the book, was thinking about this dominant question in policy from a constitutional perspective. The other thing that I would say is, you know, I think that for people who are scholars who haven't worked in the real world, or for people who especially for scholars who haven't worked in the real world, it's very hard in some ways to put yourself in the mindset of people who were in politics and the kind of constraints they felt. And so, you know, the question that where this comes up is, I think a lot of people think that the Constitution is a document that was designed by a bunch of rich old white guys in order to help their own interests economically and hurt everybody else. And the question that, you know, you'd have to ask yourself if you think that's true is, if they were really rigging the system in order to benefit themselves, why didn't they rig it more? Why didn't they go farther? If the system was that rigged from the start, why didn't they do more? And that was a question that I asked in investigating this. And And the answer was partly that the people wouldn't allow it. People in general throughout the country believed America was far more equal than other societies. And that was a constraint on the people in government. And I think anybody who has worked in government knows this and sees that people in government aren't just free-floating operatives or members, but you're responsive to your constituents. You know generally what your constituents think. You're aware of the constraints, and you have limitations of what you can do. And that's an important thing that I think you learn when you have experience that maybe is harder for others who are trying to interpret what people in the past were doing.
Well, look, you live in Nashville, and so it's not New York, it's not Washington, it's not the coast. And do you think that there is a framework that you've outlined that can connect to middle America?
Well, I have to say yes, or else none of them are going to buy the book.
You could say you just want to talk to a bunch of scholars and academics.
Well, I don't want to do that. I actually do think there's a lot to say to people out there. I mean, I think part of it is that is exactly the message of the book. I think we have a serious problem, and a problem of constitutional proportions, that for decades our country has becoming more and more unequal, and that our republic cannot sustain that kind of inequality, and that the risk that we're going to have is greater and greater instability, a greater and greater rigging of the system in the direction of oligarchy, and that unless we do something about it, the fate of our republic is not going to be a very good one. And this was something that people throughout our history understood. This might be surprising. You know, we don't really think of these as constitutional problems. I mean, I use words like oligarchy and aristocracy. This all seems like it comes from ancient Greece or Rome or something like that. But it's worth remembering that for almost all of American history, these were not esoteric terms that academics would talk about using history. Aristocracy was literally the governments of Europe that people fled from to come to America, a republic, that they revolted against in the founding, that they fought wars with or in consistently. I mean, these were monarchies, they were aristocracies. This was a live form of government that existed through up until World War II, really, in a lot of these places. And our democracy was something different, and people really understood that. And I think part of what we've lost is understanding that it's not inevitable that our democracy will succeed. This was an experiment from the beginning, and the founders understood that. And part of an experiment is that it's up to us to sustain it and to keep it working.
Well, there are some who believe, and I think I'm probably one of them, that, you know, we function in these cycles, you know, that we have peaks and valleys. I kind of feel like maybe we're in a valley, and so there's a peak. But your argument is that we are in a constitutional crisis, or moving toward a constitutional crisis if we don't deal with economic inequality.
Yeah, I don't think these are incompatible. You know, the valley gets low enough at some point, you're going to get, you'll be under the water table and we'll drown. So I think there's a place where it becomes a serious problem. And I think the concern is that we're getting to that place. And that's what worries me, is we're getting to that place now. But you're right.
Is there some measurement for that?
Well, I mean, I think we can look around and just see how much discontent there is in our society. You know, one thing that's, I think, both troubling but also kind of a foothold for progress is that if you look at the election last year, there is a common understanding among the many millions of people who supported Bernie Sanders and the many millions of people who supported Donald Trump, and that is that they agree that the system is not working, that it is rigged to work for the wealthiest people and corporations, and that Washington's not representing the interests of ordinary people. Now, they have different views about how to fix that, but there's at least a common understanding that our system is deeply broken. I think that is at the point where you get a lot of consensus over something that big, I think that's a good indicator that we have a problem.
Well, we talked about this a little bit earlier, and, you know, it's this question of whether, we're at a moment where there are some technical fixes that can be made, or does this require a wholesale rethinking about the economy, given the sort of more world, global economy that we're in, which is very different from economies of the past?
So, this is a great question. I think one of the challenges that we have, and especially that policymakers have today, is a preference for becoming very, very technical very, very quickly, and often proposing, 27-point plans of small, little things that basically keep the structure of the system in place but tweak things around the edges. I think a far better way that we should start thinking about policy is in how do we design structures in the first place that don't require, for example, regulators to be managing every little detail here and there and looking over the shoulders of people in industry. Turns out industry moves very, very quickly, and it's very, very hard for government regulators always to do that. So we should design regulations instead of trying to plug every little hole from the last crisis to be things that are simple, that are understandable, that work, and that are designed well, so that you don't have to manage them as closely on a day-to-day basis, but so that the machine runs effectively. That kind of thing requires thinking about bigger picture principles, requires thinking about big challenges that we face, and not being so focused on the kind of minor technical changes, but instead thinking systemically. To link it back to history, people actually used to think this way. This is how we did policy for a very, very long time. So, after the Depression, the argument wasn't let's, tweak a little bit here and there on the banks or on finance. It was let's create a separation between, investment banking and depository institutions. And that was Glass-Steagall. That is a major structural way of thinking about how to organize the financial sector. And it doesn't require regulators to manage every single trade or every single interaction that's happening. That's a structural principle of thinking. I think we need to think more in terms of those kinds of actions as a way to think about policy going forward.
There's such a disinterest I've found in Washington where the kind of big, bold ideas, if you will, really do get put on the back burner because it's a little more complicated to do, and it requires a lot more work. It requires going out in the country and, convincing people to make these kind of big changes that you say could reorient us into a middle-class economy or grow that middle class. And so it's hard for me to know what it is that's going to jumpstart us to get to some of the bold solutions that you've outlined.
Well, I think the first thing is people have to do it, right? So we have a couple of examples recently of success in this area. My former boss, Senator Warren, proposed a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau prior to the financial crash. When the crash happened, this made its way into the Dodd-Frank financial reforms and has been a huge force for good in regulating consumer financial products and in making it so that people who are out there are less likely to get tricked and trapped by people in the financial industry. I think that the other big example we have is healthcare. Right, this is a big, bold thing to try to cover many, many more people in our country. And the reason these things happen is because people put them out there and they push for them. And that doesn't mean, anybody paying any attention to the news knows that the healthcare fight was not easy at the beginning, nor has it been easy since. But that's
even today.
But you have to push for them and you have to sustainably advocate for them. And that's how change happens. Small changes and big changes are hard, but if you don't push for them, you guarantee you won't get them.
Well, thank you very much. That was just the beginning, round one. And so now it's time to open up the floor to questions. If you have a question, we'll need you to come over to the microphone so that we can hear your question. Just line up at the microphone. And please remember, again, to turn off your cell phone. This is a program of the Brennan Center for Justice. You can find us online at brenncenter.org and on Facebook and Twitter.
I used to have someone when I was a student who would always introduce questions by saying two things. One is because we have a big line, questions come one per customer. But they also have a question mark at the end, which is an important feature of questions.
Thank you. I was going to go right there. And so please make sure that you're asking a question.
Do you advocate a constitutional amendment to right some of these problems? When we try and fix things, it's a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there, and focus can be lost. Even though a constitutional amendment might not succeed, it might serve as a focal point for fundamental change. Could such a thing be constructed?
Yeah, so I think probably the most important place for people to think about a constitutional amendment today is in the campaign finance sector. You know, there's a number of different ways you get constitutional change. The most formal is that you can have a constitutional amendment. More informal than that is that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Our Constitution has a lot of vague phrases in it, and the Supreme Court can interpret it in different ways. So the court has, at this point, interpreted the First Amendment to be very restrictive on Congress's ability to regulate the campaign finance sector. Most of those cases, if not all, at least all the recent ones, are 5-4 decisions. If those had gone slightly differently, we would have a very different regime in how we think about campaign finance. But I think that's an area where, given that the Supreme Court has not gone in that direction, that means that the people can make change there by advocating for and passing an amendment. And I think that would be a beneficial thing both to address this problem, but also, as you said, as a focal point to really push people and organize around this, because I think it raises a question for anyone who claims that they're against big money in politics. Well, why aren't you for the constitutional amendment to stop that?
Hi, thanks very much. I really appreciated the book. I will try to keep this civil but still pointed. I work in politics.
Remember the question, Mark.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I just want to give a clarification so that he understands it. I used to work at NYU. I now work in politics, and I found that often the abstract use of the pronoun we can deteriorate political energy. So there's been parallels made between your book and Piketty's book, and people have drawn from Piketty a critique of his own discipline. I wonder if I could get you to speak for a moment about what your views are of the law and economics school of thought.
Sure. Okay, so for people who don't know, law and economics is a field that tries to integrate these two areas, legal questions and economics. There is a lot of diversity within law and economics. So there are liberals and progressives who are in it. There are conservatives who are in it. There are people who focus on empirical work, so quantitative studies. There's people who are economic theorists who apply theories of economics into law. There are people who are behavioral law and economics scholars who focus on psychology and people's personal biases and how that influences how we think about law. So as a first point, I think to your question, what I would say is this is a discipline that's extremely varied. And so as a global matter, you know, I think there's been a lot of positive things that people working in this sector have done, and some of the most interesting and insightful scholarship over the last 30 or 40 years has come from people doing work at the intersection of law and economics. At the same time, what I would say is that I think one of the challenges of taking an economic approach to legal questions is that it has, if you're not careful, you can fall into the trap of thinking that economic rules are somehow, or economic practices are somehow natural, rather than constructed by law itself. And it turns out they are constructed by law, and anyone who's here in the law school will know from their first year that all economic practices are constructed by law, just as everything is. I mean, the reason why property rights are real is because the state will enforce them when someone tries to take your property. The reason why contracts work is because the state will enforce the contract if someone tries to breach. And so that is a function of law. It's not something that is handed down by God or nature or something like that. It's we, in the sense of the democracy, the people, have come together to decide these are policies we want, and we are, through law, going to support them. And so I think one of the challenges is that much of the economic work, or at least some of the economic work in law and economics that I think has strayed, has forgotten that there's a component here where at its real bottom is that we as a society get to make laws and we decide what the laws are, not just based on what some economist tells us, but based on our moral values and intuitions, what's necessary to sustain our democracy, what's necessary for our constitutional system. And all of those questions, moral questions, political questions, democratic questions, are not things that economics usually takes into account or thinks much about. And so I think one of the challenges, if you're thinking about that as a field in general, is how to make sure that you end up taking account of these other factors, which are actually hugely important, if not the very things that make life worth living in any real sense. It's those things. It's the morality and freedom that we have, not adherence to, you know, some theory that was created in a vacuum.
Congresswoman Edwards asked a little bit about how these ideas appeal to folks in Nashville, kind of the typical archetypal middle American. But I'm curious about how this has been as a vehicle for pushing these ideas to a different group of people. I mean, you worked for Senator Warren, who has a more of a populist vein, but you also went to Harvard Law. You know, you moved in kind of elite circles a little bit. And I'm wondering if you think this kind of constitutional frame, or if you found is that this is a way to appeal to folks on the center left who are doing fine under the current economic system and need, you know, but care deeply about the integrity of our kind of democracy as a whole. I mean, we had an op-ed in the Times from a nominal Democrat yesterday saying Democrats should be much closer to Wall Street. So I'm wondering if this kind of constitutional framework is something that you found appeals to folks on the center left who don't have the same kind of populist approach to economics, period, but have a vested interest in our Constitution and the stability and integrity of our democratic system.
So I think it does, and I think that's one of the great things about this kind of an argument is that, you know, if you're concerned, you know, this doesn't come from, the argument that I'm making is an argument about American history. It's an argument about our constitutional system. It's not, there's no communism in the book. There's no socialism. It doesn't come from any of that. It comes from James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and a bunch of these guys who wrote our constitutional system. It comes from Noah Webster and, you know, Charles Pinckney, who were thinking about this, and then from people throughout our history, Daniel Webster and Lincoln and others who thought about these questions in a deep way. So I think that is appealing to people who really believe in our history and in our traditions. And one other thing I'll say, kind of linking this question with the prior one, is it's actually appealing to many economists and people who do law and economics, and the reason is the careful law and economics scholars and economists will tell you that on whatever their economic theory, there may be, about the distribution of wealth, there may be from inequality spillovers that are non-economic into impacts on, say, politics, and that would be a different kind of problem. And that would be the kind that you might still want to regulate the creation of vast economic power, even if your economic theory goes in a different direction because of these effects that it has on politics. And so I think there's a wide variety of people who can agree that this is an important place to go.
Talk about the middle class being critical for our Constitution and our government. And historically, you're talking about the Constitution, you're talking about history, but let's bring it to current events. The issue is that what is the argument that could be made today to the general population that actually has some teeth to it? Because both parties in our, you know, government talk about, you know, increasing the middle class. And in many cases, it's purely lip service. And there's the argument that the job creators are critical and that that's what you have to do. You have to put the money to the job creators. And then, of course, nothing happens. But people listen to that. So what is the argument that you could make, you know, again, in our political environment to the masses that so we do something? Because that's what you keep on talking about. We
Thank
need
you.
To do something.
So if we want to talk about an argument about where jobs come from and how our economy grows, this is more of an economic argument rather than the constitutional argument. But there's a strong economic argument to be made on exactly this that's responsive to that, which is our economy grows when there is a large middle class. And the reason why is something that every single person understands, is that when you have money and you're somebody who's working class or in the middle class, you can go out to a restaurant. When you go to a restaurant, there's a whole bunch of people who work at that restaurant. They get paid because you worked at that restaurant. If everybody stops going out to restaurants, the restaurants will all shut down. That means a lot of people will be out of work. The reason why our economy grows is because people in the middle class are able to buy things. That's where it grows from. And so something like giving an extra tax cut to Mark Zuckerberg makes no difference in the economy, because Mark Zuckerberg can buy whatever he wants. He has so much money that an extra tax cut doesn't mean he's going out to eat one more time a month. He can go out to eat whenever he wants. Not a problem for him. But if you help people who are working class or middle class who are struggling to make ends meet, these are people who will be able to, you know, get their air conditioner fixed, buy that new TV, replace, you know, buy new clothes for their kids. All of that is what creates our economy and makes it work. And that's why we need to focus on rebuilding the middle class. And how do we do that? Well, an easy one is we need to raise wages for people who are at the lowest end of the wage spectrum. We need a higher minimum wage. And this is an important piece of helping people like that actually be able to work and have a living at the same time.
I'm going to move to balance of power questions. When the radio and then television were developed, the governance elites, Congress, decided we needed an FCC. My question is, why are we not trying to regulate the internet in the same kind of direction that the radio and television are? And the argument from the, particularly the television people, is it's pretty damned unfair.
Thank you.
So I think it's a great question, and I would, the short answer is I would say that you've asked a timely question, in that in the last, I would say, year or so, and especially in the last 3 or 4 months, it's increasingly become a topic of policy conversation in Washington, whether and how to regulate internet companies. And some people have talked about this through the framework of antitrust laws. Some people have talked about it through the framework of public utilities regulation, which is what regulated communications in the early 20th century and mid-20th century. But those are kind of frameworks, and there's now, I think for the first time really in the history of the internet, a real debate that's emerging on whether and how exactly to do this. And so, you know, the short answer is hold tight, and maybe that'll happen in a few years. And the thing that I would say just to remember is it's not as if at the emergence of these new communication technologies, you know, they were immediately regulated, on day one. If you take the railroads as one of these early network industries, or you take the communication sector through the telephone, it took a long time and the growth of these things, of these industries, before Washington came in and figured out a sensible way to regulate them. So it may just be that historically we're coming up to that point now, and that's why people have started to finally debate these questions. And so
we'll see
if they do it.
You talk about briefly how the campaign to pass the amendment for direct election of senators happened in a very slow process, by which people use a litmus test to determine who they would elect to the state legislature. And I was wondering what you thought about the viability of that kind of approach today, especially since some of the rhetoric that people use to get elected is such vague and sort of empty populism that you can't really map it onto real policy most of the time. And I was wondering how that might work in this sort of environment.
I think it's a good idea, and I think people should do it, especially for campaign finance questions. I think, you know, if you really believe in preventing big money from influencing our politics and you're running for office, you should endorse doing something about that, and that should be a constitutional amendment. It should be regulations and statutes that address that question, and that, you know, we should ask people to say they're going to support that if they're running for office. If you believe that kind of stuff, I think that's what you should do, and people should be specific about it.
Thank you, Representative Edwards and Ganesh. I'm just curious about where you see the role of technology, disrupting perhaps the process of whether it's access to capital through companies like Bitcoin or social media. How do you think that it fits into the overall goals of putting middle class values first.
Great. So I think there's a couple of different things we can think about with technology. So one is the challenge that people talk about with automation and what does automation mean for jobs. And I think there's certainly a challenge that will emerge and has emerged already. And that's something that is going to be challenging for us to deal with as a society and that we're going to have to figure out. And that's one of the hard questions, I think. The other side of it is I think that there's a place where we've seen not just technology, but also the creation, as I mentioned earlier, of increased concentration of power and concentration within particular sectors. And I think that one of the ways you might think about the world is if you had a less concentrated economy, some of the problems of technology might be slightly mitigated. But the second thing is that also raises this question of what's the role of anti-monopoly or utilities or other kinds of principles in addressing the tech sector as a whole. And that's something now that people are finally starting to think about and to engage. And so these are both sort of non-answers in a way, but I think these are two of the big questions of the next, say, 5 to 10 years certainly are going to be how do we systematically think about tech platforms and what they mean, and how to think about a system to address challenges that emerge from them, while recognizing the wild amount of good that they have done and how much we like them and like a lot of features that they have. And then at the same time, how do we think about the automation challenge, which is continuing apace?
Yes, I'm not sure if this is incorporated in your definition of economics, human nature, but I don't think the imbalance of economics is the biggest problem. I think the problem with democracy is having an educated citizenry. I don't think your economic station in the country matters on that. What I think matters is that you have enough money that you can have time to invest some of it in civics.
So then, what's your question?
My question is whether, rather than income disparity, but rather people's willingness to engage in civics and have a dialogue, like I live in suburbia. People are in the same economic brackets, but they're
sir,
tribal.
There are three people behind you, so if you could just
get you could maybe address whether economics should be broadened a little bit to human nature and civics so that people are engaged and can voice their vote, for example.
So it's a great question. There's a bunch of interesting things about this. So one is just getting at the definition of what does it mean to be in the middle class? And there's actually a big debate about this. There's some people who think that it's just about economic definitions, income or wealth. There's other people who think that what it means is to be part of a certain level of education or have a certain kind of work, like white-collar work, some people have said is a definition of middle class. So there's a component in which, you might think, or some people at least certainly have thought in history, that there is a kind of cultural or educative component of what it means to be a middle-class citizen. The other kind of interesting historical point about your question is just in the founding period, part of the reason people recognized the importance of having a big middle class was because they were very worried that people might be bribable if they didn't have sufficient funds. And so you have a middle class, and that allows people to be independent and exercise their own judgment instead of potentially being bribed by wealthier people, which would maintain a kind of oligarchic system through patronage or these kinds of channels. So there's a deep part to that as being a kind of core component. So I take that as kind of a friendly thing in that I think there's an important part of our tradition that is recognized very well that education is part of this story. Do I think it's the only part of the story? The answer to this, I don't think so. And the reason why is I think that what you see is, and this goes back through almost every theorist of inequality and the Constitution, is a worry that when you have massive disparities in income and in wealth, what you end up with is the wealthiest people thinking ultimately that because they are unequal in one respect, this is what Aristotle says, their wealth, they are unequal in every respect. And in fact, because they're wealthier, they deserve to govern. They deserve to rule because they're somehow better than everyone else. because they're wealthier than everyone else. And that's a fear that then leads to oligarchy, is that people will have that feeling they'll become oligarchs. And I don't think education solves that problem. So the threat of oligarchy comes from inequality, not from an absence of education.
You talked about what the components of inequality are, but I think not so much about the why. And I'm curious whether you think the reasons that got us from the equality idea of Reconstruction to the Gilded Age are the same as the reasons that we got from the 60s equality ideas to where we are today.
So I think some of them are the same and some of them are different. The big reason that I think at a high level of generality is the same is policy. As I said earlier, you know, rules that are out there for the economy are not natural. They're things that we decide on and create through laws. And we went through a period in the Gilded Age in constitutional law, especially, that people called the Lochner era, and it was an era in which the Supreme Court basically enforced kind of laissez-faire economic ideals on the country, striking down minimum wage laws, striking down maximum hours legislation, and other populist efforts to try to right the economic ship of state. So I think in some places, policy problems remain a problem for us, and so those I think are similar. Other changes I think are different. So there was an era of industrialization back then. We're obviously post-industrialization. Technology and how automation is changing things is in some ways analogous, but I think is different. We have a much more globalized economy than they did, both in terms of capital, communications, and labor. While that was a kind of first era, or maybe second, depends on who you want to talk to, but there was an era of globalization prior to the First World War as well. I think we've gone much farther than that because of innovations that we have in transportation and communications. So I think some of the changes are kind of different in kind. Some are just different in degree.
Hi. So I noticed in your book you talked a little bit about the ideal of the yeoman farmer, which is not just about equality of wealth, but about regular people being able to produce. So I was wondering if you could say something about what's the significance for political equality, not just of equality of wealth, but of hospitability to small business versus consolidation?
Yeah, so one of the big shifts that happens in the 19th to 20th century is that we shift from becoming a country of producers, of yeoman farmers, of artisanal workers, to being a country of wage laborers in factories, and then eventually mostly we think of ourselves now as consumers rather than producers. And this has, I think, a wide variety of shifts, both in terms of rhetoric that we use and how we think about our economic system, but also in terms of how we conceive of ourselves as citizens. And part of the reason for that is in economic terms, the consumer is largely a passive kind of person, right? They consume something. The action is consumptive. A producer is very active, and there's, I think, a sense that comes with that of, as producers, thinking of ourselves as both active and engaged in doing things, but also active and engaged potentially in politics. And I think we've lost something in terms of how active we are by thinking that way. Now, the second part of that is exactly what you pointed out, which is thinking about small businesses versus large consolidated corporations and industry. And I think, you know, one thing that I'm sure, you know, you noted in your time in Congress is everybody's rhetorically in favor of small businesses. I'm not sure there's a member of either party or any party who's opposed to that. I think the question is, what do people actually do? And how do we try to foster and encourage that kind of thing where you can really build an independent economic base among individuals that allows them to be independent and allows them to thrive as members of the middle class.
Hi. You mentioned earlier that populist politicians today should rely less on rhetoric than action. And so I was wondering, in your research, what was revealed that was different in terms of the way populists in earlier America had strategies or execution, that kind of thing, than the politicians that we see now that are using populist rhetoric?
So I wouldn't necessarily say that I think we should do less rhetoric and more action. I think you need both. You know, there's an old story, there's an old phrase from Mario Cuomo who said, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. And I think that's wrong. I mean, the right answer is you campaign in both and you govern in both. And you need to both have concrete things that you want to do, and you need to sell them in a poetic and appealing way. And when you're governing, you need to have concrete things you want to do, and you need to sell them in an appealing way. Because you have to do both in order to both get things done and sustain popular support for the kinds of actions that you want. So the first thing I'd say is it's both. The second thing is, you know, and one of the things that I think is really interesting about a moment in the populist period that I think speaks to our time is there was a period in the 1890s in the South in which populists tried, unsuccessfully ultimately, but tried to unite blacks and whites in the South together in order to make economic change. And they tried to create biracial coalitions, and the argument from Tom Watson running for governor of Georgia, for example, was that both working class whites and blacks were suffering because of the wealthy class of the planter aristocrats who were in power. And his argument was things like lynchings and racism are being used to divide you. And when you have that system, when the working people are divided, all it does is perpetuate the system where the elites have power. And this was Watson's argument. He lost the election because of violence and force and fraud designed to prevent him to lose the election because people were worried about what would happen if he won. But that was a place where I think people really understood that, you know, we need to unite people who actually have a lot in common. And are not succeeding or not having the opportunity to succeed under the current structure of our system, and that reaching out to people in that way and trying to unite people instead of allowing this kind of divide and conquer approach to really go unchecked in a serious way, I think that's something that we can learn from the populist era.
Well, I can't think of a better note on which to end this discussion. Thank you very much. This has been NYU Law School's Brennan Center for Justice. Really riveting discussion today with Professor Ganesh Sitharaman about his recent book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution and Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Thank you so much, because I think it's... you know, we need to figure out another way in which we can think about our Constitution so that those of us who do get the challenge to govern can do that in poetry and in prose. Thank you.